Pull up a chair. The fire in the wood stove there is doing just fine, and I've got a story tonight that I've been saving. It's a good one to close on. It's about the biggest airplane anybody ever lifted off the water, a man everybody had already written off as finished, and 26 seconds that nobody on that boat saw coming. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar. Stay with me a while. Now, before I get rolling, let me tell you who keeps the coffee hot around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, your first solo, your private, your instrument rating, all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, that's the whole point of this show, isn't it? The stories. Go take a look at AviationSoul.com. All right, settle in. I want you to picture Long Beach, California, the morning of November 2nd, 1947. Cool air coming off the harbor. A little haze burning off the water the way it does on the California coast. And sitting out there on the surface, riding low like some enormous gray water bird, is the single largest flying machine human beings had ever assembled. They called it the Spruce Goose. Now, here's the first thing you need to know, and it's the thing that always got under the skin of the man who built it. It wasn't made of spruce, hardly any of it. It was built almost entirely of birch. But Spruce Goose rhymes, and it sticks in the mouth, and the newspapers loved it, and Howard Hughes hated it until the day he died. The proper name was the Hughes H4 Hercules, but nobody calls it that, even now, even me. Let me give you the numbers, and I want you to really sit with these because they're hard to believe even today. The wingspan was 320 feet. 320. To put that in your hand, a Boeing 747, the jumbo jet, the queen of the skies, spans about 211 feet. This wooden flying boat built in the 1940s had a wing more than 100 feet wider than a 747. That record for wingspan stood for almost 70 years. 70. She had 8 engines, 8 Pratt & Whitney radials, each one cranking out 3,000 horsepower, swinging propellers 17 feet across. The tail stood as high as an 8-story building. She weighed in around 400,000 pounds. And the whole thing, this Leviathan, was made of laminated wood, glued and shaped and pressed by hand because wartime America needed its aluminum for fighters and bombers and couldn't spare it for some dreamer's flying boat. Now here's where it gets interesting. Why does a thing like this even exist? Why would anybody build a 400,000 pound airplane out of birch? Go back to 1942. The country's at war. German U-boats are prowling the Atlantic, and they are sinking Allied ships faster than the shipyards can build them. Every cargo vessel that goes down takes tanks and trucks and men and supplies to the bottom with it. A fellow named Henry Kaiser, a great industrialist, a man who built ships faster than anyone thought possible, he looks at this problem and he says, "What if we just fly the cargo over the submarines? What if we build flying boats so big they can carry a whole company of troops, or a Sherman tank, right across the ocean, up where no torpedo can touch them?" Kaiser needed an airplane man. And there was nobody in America more airplane than Howard Hughes. You know the name. Most folks today know Hughes as the recluse. The germaphobe locked away in a hotel room with long fingernails and Kleenex boxes on his feet. That's the sad ending, and it's real, but you've got to wipe that picture away for tonight, because in the 1940s, Howard Hughes was the most glamorous man in America. He was a record-setting pilot. He flew around the entire world in less than 4 days in 1938 and got a ticker tape parade up Broadway for it. He designed airplanes. He produced Hollywood movies, he dated movie stars, he was rich, he was handsome, and he was absolutely certifiably obsessed with getting things perfect. And that obsession, friends, is the engine of this whole story. The thing that made him great is the same thing that nearly destroyed him. The government gives Hughes and Kaiser a contract. $18 million, build 3 of these giant flying boats, and Hughes, being Hughes, he doesn't want to just build it. He wants to build it perfect. He wants to solve every problem. He frets over every curve of that wooden hull, every joint, every laminate. There's a process they use to shape the wood, a method of gluing thin layers of birch under heat and pressure, and Hughes drives his engineers half mad chasing perfection in it. And the war? The war moves on without him. By the time the airplane is anywhere near ready, Kaiser has long since walked away from the project in frustration. The U-boat threat has been beaten by other means. 1945 comes, the war ends. And there sits this enormous unfinished wooden airplane, having cost the taxpayers and Hughes himself something north of $23 million, and it has never left the ground. Never even been finished. Now picture the heat coming down on Howard Hughes. 1947. He gets hauled in front of the United States Senate. There's a war profiteering investigation, and Hughes is the star attraction. A senator named Owen Brewster is going after him hard. The newspapers are having a field day. They've got their nickname, the Spruce Goose, and they're using it like a club, a flying lumberyard, Hughes's folly, a monument to a millionaire's vanity that'll never fly. The phrase they kept throwing at him was that it was a boondoggle, a waste wood that would never leave the water. And here's the thing. Hughes himself, under oath in front of those senators, he said something I've never forgotten. He said this airplane was his life's work. He said if it was a failure, he'd probably leave the country and never come back. He meant it, his whole reputation, everything, riding on a pile of birch in a hangar in Long Beach. So in November of 1947, between Senate hearing sessions, Hughes goes back to California. The official word is we're going to run some taxi tests. Just taxi tests. Run her up and down the harbor. Check the engines, check the controls, gather some data. Nobody's flying anything today. That's the story. He invites the press aboard, reporters, photographers, a radio man or two. Some of them climb up into that cavernous wooden hull, and the rest follow along in boats out on the water. There are 30-some people aboard the airplane, all told. Hughes is in the left seat. There's a hydraulic engineer named Dave Grant beside him working the throttles and the systems. Cool morning, calm water. Now, I want you to be aboard for this. Close your eyes if you're not driving. You're sitting inside what feels like the belly of a wooden ship, except it's an airplane. The smell is varnish and birch and oil and salt air. Hughes fires up those 8 big radials one at a time, and the whole hull begins to shudder and rumble. That's not a sound you hear. It's a sound you feel in your chest and your teeth, 24,000 horsepower coming alive. The water beneath you, slapping and hissing against the hull. First taxi run, he runs her up, gets her moving across the harbor, brings her back. Reporters scribbling notes, second run a little faster. The big boat carving awake like an ocean liner, some of the press satisfied, they get off, they figure they've seen the show. A wooden boat that goes fast on the water, fine, but a few of them stay. And on the third run, Howard Hughes does not tell anybody what he's about to do. He pushes those 8 throttles up. The Hercules gathers speed. 40 knots, 50. The hull's pounding across the chop, spray flying back over the windows. And the men aboard feel her starting to get light, starting to skip. The way a flying boat does when the wings beginning to take the weight off the water. And Dave Grant, sitting next to him, glances over, and Hughes has got that look. And Hughes eases back on the yoke, and the pounding stops, just like that. The slapping and the hammering of the hull against the water, gone. Silence underneath, except for the roar of those engines. Because there's no more water under her. The biggest airplane ever built has come off the surface of Long Beach Harbor. She climbed maybe 70 feet, held it for about a mile down the harbor. Roughly 26 seconds in the air, somewhere around 80 knots, 26 seconds. That's it. That's the whole flight, the only flight she would ever make. But oh, what those 26 seconds meant? Because the man who said it would never fly, the senators, the newspapers, the whole chorus of doubters who'd nicknamed her and mocked her and called her a monument to one man's ego, every one of them was answered in 26 seconds over a California harbor. She flew. The wood flew. The thing the experts swore was too big, too heavy, too crazy. It got up off the water, and it flew straight, and it flew level. And Howard Hughes set her back down soft, as you please. Now, was it a practical airplane? No, let's be honest in this hangar. The way pilots are honest with each other, it was already obsolete. The war it was built for was 2 years over. The jet age was coming. A wooden flying boat the size of a city block was never going to be the future of anything. In cold engineering terms, the H-4 Hercules was a dead end, but that's not the same as a failure, not even close.
Because here's what I believe, and I've thought about this airplane a long time. There's a difference between a thing that's useful and a thing that's worth doing. Hughes proved that something that enormous could be made to fly at all. He proved the wood would hold. He proved his own engineers right and his accusers wrong. And he proved something about himself, too. Something about not letting the loudest voices in the room tell you what's impossible before you've tried it. You want to know how much that flight meant to the man? Howard Hughes kept that airplane for the rest of his life. He never flew her again, not once, but he refused to let her be scrapped. He paid a fortune, something like $1 million a year, to keep her in a climate-controlled hangar with a full crew maintaining her, ready to fly for decades. Folks said it was madness, maybe. But I think the man just couldn't bear to let go of the one thing that answered everybody who ever doubted him. She outlived him. Hughes died in 1976, and that beautiful wooden giant, she eventually found her way to where she belongs. And here's the part that warms my old heart. You can go see her, right now.
She's at the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum in McMinnville, Oregon. They built a building around her, a great glass hall, and she fills it the way a cathedral fills with light. You walk in under that wing, that 320-foot wing of laminated birch, and you crane your neck back, and you cannot believe a human being made this with his hands and his stubbornness and his refusal to quit. Children walk under her with their mouths open, so do grown pilots. I've stood under that wing myself, and I'll tell you, it gets you right in the throat. That's why I save a story like this for the end of the night. Because aviation isn't only about the airplanes that worked, it's about the reach. It's about somebody standing in front of the whole world being told no. This is impossible, this is foolish, this is wood that'll never leave the water, and then going out on a cool November morning and lifting 400,000 pounds of birch into the California sky, just long enough to prove them all wrong. 26 seconds sometimes, that's all it takes. I leaned on the good folks at the Evergreen Aviation Museum and the historical record from those 1947 Senate hearings to put this one together tonight, and I'm grateful to everyone who's kept that airplane and her story alive. If you want more tales like this one, you know where to find me. RadioHanger.com. Now go put another log on the fire. Get some rest, and the next time somebody tells you a thing can't be done, you remember the spruce goose. I'm Tal Dreger. Keep the blue side up, and I'll see you next time.